No, I think I can't think of anything in the World Cup, but I remember playing in P and Merrick Pringle was a big hunter and he would hunt warthogs and, you know, he did. And we had all these massive cupboards made in the in our changing rooms, but they were really ugly. But anyway, they were massive. And I'll never forget Merrick Pringle cutting off the head of a warthog and bringing it into Aldine Baptiste's locker. And the minute Aldine got to practice, he opened it up and... I mean, all hell broke loose. I mean, you can imagine this guy from the West Indies, he goes bloody warthog head in his sort of a, you know, locker. It was extremely funny. And, you know, I could still remember I was on the field and you could hear him screaming from the changing room.
Welcome to The Biggest Man in Cricket with your host, David Brook.
We are here at St. George's Park. And we've got the coach of the Warriors side, former Proteas champion, Robin Peterson. Welcome to The Biggest Man in Cricket.
Thanks for having me. It's an honor to be here with you today.
Thanks, Rob. Firstly, I just want to say you've had an unbelievable season. We'll get to your playing days throughout the whole episode. But I think it's fantastic to see the Warriors have done so well. People know in the show that we always talk about Cape Cobras and Western Province, but it's great to see the Warriors doing so well, and that's obviously it's starting with you. So congratulations on an incredible season. Just take us through the season for you as head coach of the side.
Thank you very much. Firstly, I can't believe the season's over. But it was a great season for us. We're a young group, and I've got some of the most exciting young players in South Africa. So it always gives you that extra motivation to come to work, but I've got to give the players all the credit. You know, it's easy to get the players, but then for them to buy into what we're trying to achieve, you know, that's a whole different ballgame in itself. But, you know, they must take huge credit. I mean, the leadership group, the young players. We had an 8-player turnover from last season to this season. So it's only the beginning for them, I feel. And they seem very motivated and a connected group, which always helps you know, to try and win anything. So it's been a successful season and hopefully it can continue.
How difficult is it as a coach? Because you see some of these guys have one good campaign and all of a sudden they get T20 gigs around the world and stuff. But how difficult it is these days compared to you've obviously played the game for many years to keep these kids grounded?
I think that's part of my role because I got the back end of T20 cricket. Yeah. So I try and always make them see the long-term picture instead of just the now and the money. And I mean, it's very difficult for them. You know, everything's on social media. They their own marketing tools, posting all their performances on social media. So it's a different world, you know, and but it is important, you know, that you keep their feet on the ground and they keep worrying about the next performance because your stocks can go down so quickly. You know, as quick as it goes up, as quick as it can drop. So you need to remain humble, try and perform and keep developing your skills. Till the day you retire, I always tell them, you're never a complete cricketer. So it's an exciting job that I have, but I really enjoy working with young players.
Do you fall into the camp of Red Bull cricket is still the OG and your skill level there is where you actually learn the game? Or are you white ball dominates in world cricket right now? Where do you stand on that?
I think Red Bull cricket will always be the pinnacle for most of the cricketers. Even today, when you speak to some of them in the dressing room, guys like Tristan Stubbs, who plays cricket all around the world, he talks about his love for, he always wants to come play a four-day game for the Warriors, which is testimony to what the young players want. And then you saw Matthew Bredsky talk about his ambition to get back into the test team. So our young best players still see test cricket as the pinnacle, but how long that will last, who knows? You know, the game and the world's changing so quickly and, you know, the amount of money in and fame in T20 cricket around the world. Who knows the younger generation below that and what their aspirations are, you know, as to play test cricket. It may just be that they want to play T20 cricket, but I think it's important to keep test cricket alive. I think there's a rich culture within our schools here, still the traditional format. And, you know, long may that continue because I think it's going to be an important part in taking our test team forward is actually our school system.
And then obviously there's a cricket services department at EB Cricket and Warriors, et cetera. But how close do you get to those schools in terms of the head coach of the professional team, in terms of do you get to see youngsters coming through school level? Do you invite them over to have a net once in a while?
I think the guys that have just left school, we try and get them all to our nets. I think we have quite a talented group. There's a couple of wrist spinners, left arm spinners, a couple of all-rounders that we sort of get to all our practices. I think because it's such a small city and such a small cricket community, I think those things happen naturally. And we try and involve our Colts team, our main Warriors team, and a couple of our guys that have just left the school to come and join all our training sets. I think it's really important that you connect, you know, sort of DNA and a strand with all the teams. And I think it's one of the easier places to do it.
Yeah.
You know, the varsity is exceptional with that. They carry a lot of the players that are sort of left school, offer them bursaries. So it's been a great relationship that we had using their facilities in the winter and polishing up their side as well. So it's great to watch Brietsky batting with one of our young players from the varsity in the middle. And, you know, that all conversations that take place, it's priceless. Because as a coach, you know, they only listen to you for so much and they actually learn. You know, peer-to-peer learning is where they actually get most of the information and experience.
You kind of are the perfect coach for this Warrior side at this time, because you come from this region. You started your career here. Just take us through the early part. I know it's changed now, but take us through where it all started for you.
I think like most kids, we were still, I mean, pre-apartheid kids, in terms of cricket and the system. And, I'll never forget still playing street cricket. And I mean, there's Alviro Peterson, who played test match cricket for South Africa, Ashwell Prince, who's now the batting coach for the Proteas currently. And these are people that we played street cricket with that in the summer. It was cricket and everybody was playing. And, you know, as you progress, you start joining a club, and we joined Galvindale Cricket Club, where most of us played. Garnet Kruger, Wayne Parnell may have been involved at some level, and Russell Domingo was also there. So, you know, because it's such a small city, and you know, you tend to rub shoulders with everybody in cricket. So those are some of the names that I grew up playing with, and you know, sort of dovetailing our careers a little bit. I mean, I followed Cape to Ash to Western Province at one point. So, you know, these are things that happen in careers. But I'll never forget a guy that's played a big role in identifying me. It was actually Adrian Burrell when I was 14 years old. So. I'll never get on the B field over here. He saw me play and came to ask me a question and told me if you hit a six, not a very big field, by the way, but it seemed huge back then, that he's going to pick me for the under 15 team. And I ended up hitting the six on the next ball. And then all of a sudden I was in his program, you know, being identified and being coached by him to a young level. So he played a big role, because he didn't just leave you at school in your own devices. He used to actually come and fetch you, you know, with Gerald Majola at United Cricket Club. So I ended up playing for them in New Brighton with AD, myself, and could have been one other. I can't remember the name right now. But, yeah, we ended up playing club cricket from school. So it wasn't only school cricket. He played a big role. And then, obviously, Russell Domingo became the coach. He also sort of pulled you through the ranks. And then AD became the main coach of Eastern Province, and he sort of got me in at a very young age. So, you know, there's always someone that takes risks on you, and young players, and AD Burrell was that guy for me.
He's the theme in a few of our chats already in the other episodes, but Ash obviously spoke about, he was our first guest on the show, and he spoke about the impact of club cricket. All of a sudden he was a youngster that was playing with 35-year-old men that have been through a bit of life already. And, you know, and that I'm wondering if that's lost these days in club cricket. I know probably here some of the guys will play some club if they're not playing any games, or if they're not making the team here. Colts system is not really that strong at the moment. So is that lost these days? Are youngsters still going back to play a bit of club?
I think it is. I think with the expansion of school cricket and it becoming so big, that I think, you know, that when you were at school, being able to go and play one or two club games with some hardened, you know, club cricketers, even some ex-professionals, you know, whether they were from the UK or current professionals, you know, that's definitely missing. I felt when I started, I certainly played against some of them, you know, and that certainly made sure that you were toughened up a little bit, you know, in no uncertain terms, that made you know that you're going to have to work to get anywhere within the game. But once you start passing those little tests, playing against those professionals, I think it really does stand you in good stead. But that's definitely something that's lost. I'm not sure how you ever going to get it back. Yeah, I don't think it's possible.
Yeah.
But I'm certainly a better cricketer and person, you know, when I look back forward for playing in that era.
Was it always cricket for you or the other sports? I know Ash played everything under the sun pretty much. Was that similar for you?
I think I loved every sport. I love football. I mean, I remember like playing with Ash and just like casual games in the street because we were in the similar area. Tennis as well. We played a bit of tennis. And
between the two of you, the competitiveness must have been through the bloody roof there.
I thought Ash's brother was a fantastic cricketer. Yeah. And I still play tennis with him today when I get an opportunity. And Ash's dad.
Yeah.
So I can tell you that you think Ash is competitive. Yeah. I think there's nothing on the two of them. So, no, it's fantastic. But, I played hockey. I think I come from a family of people that were really big in hockey in the community. It was really big in Eastern Province, hockey within our community. And I ended up fortunately progressing through the ranks and I managed to play, you know, SS schools for a couple of years at Alexander Road High where I attended. And obviously Neil Bilby was the director of sport at Grey High. He was my coach in cricket and hockey at high school. Okay. So he played a big role in terms of grooming me in both sports. So I ended up actually playing for Eastern Province men hockey. Yeah. And then I had to make a decision in terms of where you want to go. And then Clive Rice actually spoke to my parents about bringing me to the National Academy after school. Yeah. And then that's where the hockey link sort of broke. But I still continued afterwards in winters. I hated preseason with cricket. So I always used to tell Eddie Birrell, I'll get my fitness in at hockey and I could get a break from cricket. And then he was okay with it. But I always felt that when I had a hockey season, I'd always have a good cricket season. Mm. So, it did help, you know, the cricket.
And then you came through the Eastern Province route. Yeah. So some of your kind of your teammates were, give us some names of who you started your career with there.
Yeah, I played with some characters. I think another one, like growing up with Galvindale cricket was Aldin Baptiste. Uh-huh. I think you managed to share a dressing room with him. Dave Callan. I mean, these guys I'm still in touch with today. Merrick Pringle, Mark Rushmead, who also played a big role. I thought he was probably one of the best captains of spin in South Africa. You know, he played spin very well. And I thought he always taught me the right way on how to bowl as a spinner, even though he was a batsman. So I learned a lot from him. And then, you know, guys like Ashwell, Prince, as I mentioned before. So these were really, you know, icons of not only South African cricket, but cricket within this province. So I really enjoyed Merrick. He was a character in the dressing room. He never made you feel that there was any hierarchy within cricket, like senior versus junior players. I thought he was always that conduit. So with him, I thought he was fantastic with young players. And then, you know, we had a great system here where young players were always backed. And I felt Eddie Birrell and the system we had coming through here really gave us that opportunity to showcase our skills.
Just in terms of like the professionalism of domestic cricket at the time, coming into that environment, you've always been quite an astute or not, I wouldn't say serious, because sometimes you look a bit serious on TV, but you've always had a natural professionalism about you. Do you think that aided your way into professional cricket in terms of easing into it?
I think a lot of those things, you know, you sort of learn from people growing up. I think Aldin Baptiste was the first person that we looked up to as a professional. And he was probably, and, you know, I got a bit of taste of Kepler Wessels here, you know, when I came through the system and two guys that played international cricket, one for the West Indies, Aldin, and obviously Kepler for Australia. So I think you just steal a little bit with your eyes coming through the system, understanding that you need to do this. But like any young player, you get pulled away and you get distractions. But it's about at least realizing that there's value in discipline and training hard and hopefully the rest will take care of itself. So, you know, definitely, I wouldn't say it was natural. And it was a lot, you know, you had to learn from the senior players.
Do you ever laugh when you hand out your meal allowance to your players now? And how much they get as a meal allowance compared to maybe how much you got. Is there those moments where you go, shit, you guys, you don't know what it was like back then?
I think we just had a conversation when it was raining in one of the games a couple of weeks ago, and the guys were talking because it's contract time now.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's everything's up in the air, and there's a lot of chatter about it in the dressing room. And players asked me, "Sheesh, coach, what did you get for your first contract?" And I was like, "I want you guys to guess what I got my first contract." And they were like, "No, it was this. It was 100,000. It was." I said, "Guys, my first contract was 10,000 rand to play professional cricket." And they could not believe it. I said, "You guys have to count your blessings. Yeah. It has never been a better time to be a cricketer globally than now, if you actually pay attention and improve yourself."
So,
10,000 rand, 800 rand a month. You know, that's what they used to come up with.
10,000 rand a year, not even
10,000 rand a year.
Sure, but okay.
So 800 rand a month. And I remember with Garnet Kruger and myself on similar money. And I think, the brickmakers, we used to free the car down just to save some petrol. So those are the stories. But it was great that 800 rand made you feel like a millionaire, you know, at the time. You know, it lasted you. And it was so great because you know, you were young and, you know, you realized that you could be independent, you know, away from your parents. It wasn't a lot of money, but like I said, we felt like millionaires when we got it at the time.
That's amazing. Just some, you know, you've done well in domestic cricket. Mm-hmm. Was there ever a moment where you go, "Okay, I'm ready for international cricket now and pick me, you know, like I'm ready, bring it on"?
I think when I first got selected, I was 20 years old. I had a decent season for my first season, but I never had the goal of playing for South Africa at 20.
Mm.
You know, I always thought I'll be really solid by 28.
Yeah.
So I thought I needed to go through 5, 6, or even 7 year, 8 year period of play where I could accumulate enough games and experience and learn how to be a professional. And then all of a sudden, Nicky Buya had an injury scare, and because I was the only left arm spinner that had done well at the time, they sort of flew me to Sri Lanka. So I got a call from Ghulam Raja to say, "Listen, we have an injury scare. You have to fly to Sri Lanka." I mean, I didn't even know where Sri Lanka was on the map. I didn't know how to take an international flight on my own.
Yeah.
You know, I'd always travel in groups and you'd add a leader that would sort of give you your passport. And all of a sudden I was doing all these things. I remember having a stopover in Singapore, and I mean, it was all total fun. What a great experience. Yeah. You know, you got there, and I mean, guys like Jacques Callis were there, Mackay Antini, Roger Telemarkus, Paul Adams. You know, these were guys that Sean Pollock, Lance Klusner, Neil McKenzie, just to mention a few names, were part of that squad. So there's no way I was ready for international cricket. Mm. I mean, I realized that pretty quickly. You know, but very fortunate and blessed to get the opportunity. So, you know, when you thrust in that, you're not going to say no, you're going to go and take it. And, you know, I learned from a lot of people, and, you know, I got to meet Muirthaya Muralitharan. I got to meet, Ranga Naherath as left arm spinners and having conversations. And, you know, those all stimulated my thinking and now to try and become better at the time.
In South African cricket, kind of like the era before you and kind of leading up to your era, left arm spinners or spinners in general were very defensive in South African cricket. And it still played out, you know. So did you consider yourself an attacking bowler that was forced to be defensive in an environment where, you know, maybe Gogi was an attacking spinner, but left arm spinners were, I mean, Dale Steyn spoke about in a previous episode about poor old Paul Harris in terms of like having to just bowl, and then he would take one wicket and then Graham would hand the ball back to Dale and said, "Do the rest." And Paul was like, "I'm on a roll now," you know. So tell us about that.
It's a funny one because I never ever looked, and because I had Mark Rushmere, who was an attacking thinker, captain. He never looked at left arm spin as a defensive option. So growing up, he always told me, toss the ball up, bring mid off up, throw it wide. And so you started learning all these other skills on how to get batsmen out using angles and different lines. And the higher I went, and the rest of South African captains and our teams looked at spin as a defensive option. So I had to quickly, you know, shift my thinking from a boy learning that I'm the attacking weapon or I'm allowed to go for more runs in the pursuit of wicket to your job is just to do this. And of course, if you want to play for South Africa, you do anything. So 100%. If you have to adapt your role and be flexible, I mean, that's part of the game. And that's kind of what you try to do. But I didn't think it ever sat naturally with me as a person. I'm someone that I like to take risks. I like to, you know, move games forward. And, you know, as long as there's an understanding between the captain, the coach, and what we're trying to do, I think that's important. So, yes, I agree with Dale that I felt for Arrow over years. I sat in the dressing room and I'm like, there is no way I'll be able to do that. Test after test after test. So, it was something that I struggled with initially, but you became used to it when you understood that this is my role. I'm bowling with Dale Steyn, Vern Philander, Mornay Morkel, that I have to do this role to ensure that they do their roles as well, that function even better.
And, you know, were you always a spinner first, or were you a batter that could spin a bit? And
I think I was I started out as a opening batsman. So I batted everywhere from 1 to 11. I was a wicket keeper. Well, you know, I remember going to EP under 15 trials and almost making it as a wicket keeper, top order batter. And then, you know, I keep teasing AD Burrell. I became a left arm spinner. Just at primary school, because I was the only one that could do it and could actually turn it. So, you know, I ended up doing that skill on the cricket team, but I actually bowled wrist spin. And when I showed AD Burrell, no, I bowl left arm orthodox and I bowl left arm wrist spin. He actually told me, no, Robbie, you got to stop. You just got to bowl, turn the wall away from the bat. And then, you know, I still tease him today that it cost me so much money because wrist spin is so much more in demand. And I have to say, I actually enjoyed bowling wrist spin more than finger spin when I grew up. I mean, I never really did it at junior because all the coaches wanted you to turn the ball away from the right hander. But, you know, if I think back now, that I got more joy, or because Shane Warne was always someone I looked up to. So I thought, geez, that must be exciting to be able to do something along those lines. And ended up being a finger spinner. But I have to say that I love wrist spinners. And I have one here with us, Thomas Carver, who plays at my Cape Town. So, you know, I've always had a soft spot for wrist spinners because they affect games. And
there is something about a wrist spinner which, like, you never know. It could be a long open, you could get whacked out the ground, or you could, like, have an unbelievable delivery that can defeat some of the best bats in the world. I wouldn't say a dying art, but it's a beautiful art, and it doesn't come around too often.
That's fantastic. I mean, at the level now, at domestic level, we've got Thomas Carver, Sean Von Berg, Josh Priott, Naba Peter, that are all playing. I mean, that's probably the most wrist spinners we've had in our system in a very long time. So it's exciting. But no, they're little magicians, man. You know, don't expect them to keep the rate down.
Yeah.
I mean, we certainly don't expect Tommy to do that. But if he opens up the game with something special, that makes it a little bit easier for the other bowlers. So, no, I love watching wrist spin. I think I've always enjoyed watching Shane Warne and Muralitharan and these bowlers. I think when the fast bowler bowls, you know, you got to make a cup of tea and then you come back and watch the spinners bowl. So I really enjoy that part of the game.
Oh, you're on like a WhatsApp group where there's just spinners on there?
No.
You can reveal that.
I think I used to be on a group, but I am on so many cricket groups of ex-players, but we haven't quite had a spinners union one. Yeah. But I think when you see each other, you know, there's always that acknowledgement that, you know, we've done the long road and it's a hard art to do in South Africa. But, you know, in saying that, you know, like watching guys like Keshav and Simon Harmer perform at Test Match cricket, I look at what a long way we've come. I'm thinking about spin bowling, you know, Sen Muthusami also plays here with us. You know, we've come such a long way in thinking of it as an attacking weapon. But I think the pitchers in South Africa have differed a little bit.
Yeah, Wanderers is spinning never back in the day would you see that.
You know, so it's nice that the spin bowler has a little bit of something to look forward to coming, you know, into cricket matches. And it certainly wasn't the case when I played. You know, you always the fast bowlers had all the conditions, but in their favor. But I love watching Keshav and Simon Harmer rip apart the Indian team away from home.
Are we still doing those spin camps that I'm sure you went on? Are we still doing those, sending guys over to India?
I don't think recently. I think it was in the past, but I think Paul Adams is kind of tossed with having a look at managing all the spin bowlers around the country. You know, it's an important part of cricket. Now, if you want to win any World Cup, which is something that's eluded us, you need a very good spin attack.
Yeah.
And you need variety of spinners, leg spinners, left arm wrist spinners, finger spinners and off spinners. And I think we have the talent in South Africa, but I think we can do a little bit more to polish them up and maybe give them those opportunities in India.
I remember that that camp actually used to impress me because they used to send batters as well to play against the, you know, coaches in India or like 15-year-old kids that are just like spinning the ball 90 degrees kind of thing in India. And it helped our batsmen grow their game against spin. But the fact that we've got more guys now playing domestic cricket with this kind of skill is going to aid our spin. Obviously, the pitches are not like in India or Pakistan or whatever it is, but it will help the game, which is fantastic to see. You talk about you started out batting, but I mean, I looked at your stats, your all-round skills, your stats overall, your batting stats are amazing as well. Like you weren't just a lower order batsman; you contributed properly.
Yeah, I always try to contribute. But batting is something I was always proud of. You know, I always wanted to make a contribution to the team. And I felt that when the team was under pressure, that's when they needed me the most. So if you probably look at most of my performances, it probably came when the team was in a touch and go situation. I don't know. I think maybe in my personality, it's something that I really enjoy is being under a little bit of pressure to perform. So I think that's why. But no, it's something I work very hard on. You know, I knew that, you know, to keep my place in the team, I couldn't only bowl. I needed to be one of the best fielders. And I needed to add something with a bat where guys could rely on me lower down the order if things didn't function high up. So, no, it was great. But I had great coaches, you know, that would, like AD Birtle, would bat me up the order and give me opportunity to grow as a cricketer in the youth structures over here. So, yeah, it's just great that I could have a couple of good innings and enjoy myself internationally.
Talking about internationally, two World Cups, if I'm not mistaken.
Three
World Cups. Sorry. Firstly, you know, it's every player's dream to get that call to say you're in the squad for a World Cup. How does that even feel? I can't even imagine how that feels.
Yeah. I mean, I always wanted to play a World Cup. I mean, I'm sure you even remember the World Cup in Australia, the first one in coloured clothing. I think that sort of captured everybody's imagination about playing in one. And then I'll never forget Ghulam Raja told me, no, you got to come to Durban. And I was like, why are we in Durban? And obviously they didn't let the cat out the bag. I think maybe more with the senior players, but for the young ones, they didn't say too much. And then all of a sudden, you know, we got given our shirts and been told that we're in the World Cup squad. And I'll never forget one thing I'll remember about that. That was 2003. It was the World Cup at home in South Africa. Obviously, next year's the next one in South Africa. But I'll never forget Graeme Smith not making it at the time. And him and watching that whole emotion play out. And, you know, I was just ecstatic that I was in it. But you look at, you know, how many players want to play in a World Cup and how many miss out on that opportunity. And I was privileged enough to play in three. And to have that experience with guys like Gary Kirsten, Alan Donald. I mean, I played with Alan Donald, you know, the legend. You know, Jonty Rhodes was there, Gershel Gibbs. So we had some magnificent players, you know, in that unfortunately we couldn't get to the semi-final. We lost out DL in Durban.
DLS, so it's still DL at the time,
So
we won't talk about that ever again.
We won't talk about it. But no, it's a great moment for any cricket. I think that's what you love for, is to play in World Cups.
You all of a sudden become nationally known around the streets and stuff. And did you enjoy that part of the game, or were you very much like, I want to go home after a game and just secluded?
No, I think it was different back then. I think it's young, it's new. You sort of tag along with the senior players a little bit, whether that's right or wrong, you know. But no, I didn't feel anything about it. I think the older I got, it's something that I didn't really enjoy. It's like everybody knowing who you are and but it's something you realize that you got to get comfortable with, even though it's uncomfortable. So yeah, it's something that I didn't really. I'm sort of someone that's sort of extrovert, introvert. I like to have my own space, but I like to share it with other people that I enjoy hanging out with, you know. So yeah,
some of the just give us a couple of funny stories about tours or World Cups that hasn't seen the light of day until right now on this episode.
No, I think I can't think of anything in the World Cup, but I remember playing in P, and Merrick Pringle was a big hunter and he would hunt warthogs and, you know, he did. And we had all these massive cupboards made in our changing rooms, but they were really ugly. But anyway, they were massive. And I'll never forget Merrick Pringle cutting off the head of a warthog and bringing it into Aldine Baptiste's locker. And the minute Aldine got to practice, he opened it up and, I mean, all hell broke loose. I mean, you can imagine this guy from the West Indies, he goes bloody warthog head in his sort of, a, you know, locker. It was extremely funny. And, you know, I could still remember I was on the field and you could hear him screaming from the changing room, which was totally hilarious. But, you know, that was something I remember that was really funny. Yeah. And then obviously everybody remembers Herschel's 175. Yeah. You know, he enjoyed himself. And then I thought it was quite funny, his response, and it actually got the best out of Herschel, you know. So
how was that? I mean, just take us through that.
Yeah, it was actually the time when it was, you know, you say sort of had that 12 super sub.
Yeah.
So I'd played in that series. Yeah. I played in the first three games. And they ended up losing the one in Durban. So that went 2-2.
Mm.
And we went to, obviously, everybody was under pressure now because it's 2-2.
Yeah.
You led the series 2-0. And this great Australian team that won so many World Cups are, you know, chomping at the bit to beat South Africa again. And no doubt within the stress, you know, I remember going to lunch with Herschel at Sandton
that
Square.
Started with you.
It's not my fault. And so they left him at lunch. And then, you know, he was obviously, I mean, I never saw him, but, you know, the story is quite legendary. And to watch him actually perform on that day, what people don't forget is we went in the field first. But to watch Herschel's fielding performance, if you go, forget the batting, the way he fielded that day was extraordinary for everything that's happened. So we only look at the 175, but I encourage everybody to go look at how he fielded and the amount of ground he covered. You know, certainly got the best out of him, for sure.
I mean, like, everyone knows what happened on that game, but, like, from your perspective inside the change room afterwards, like, what were you doing? Like, were you just sitting there watching what was going on? Quite surreal.
It was amazing. And, you know, I got to doff my hat off to the Australian team because I think for them to bat first and get 400, I mean, it felt like every second ball was going to the fence. And even the Knicks were going. And
it's like Hong Kong Sixers done 50 overs.
It's unbelievable. And then, you know, for them to post,
4-3-4
was incredible. And then I can confirm that Joe Callis did actually say that. In the dressing room.
Folklore.
Yeah, and it's not folklore. And I mean, it just lifted the pressure.
I mean, that must have been hilarious to hear that he said, what was it, that they're 20 short or something.
I think he said they were 15 short or something. And then, I mean, it sort of broke the ice a little bit. And everybody, you know, sort of had a good giggle, never thinking that we were going to get there. And then all I remember was Buta Dipnar getting out early and then Graham going to the crease. And I mean, he also played a magnificent innings. He got 90-odd in 70 balls.
Yeah.
But to watch those two, like, sort of take on the Australians was amazing. And, you know, we never looked back. We always thought, oh, we're going to end short. We're going to end short. Then all of a sudden, you're getting closer and closer. And then the pressure's on to win.
I was going to say now, at what point were you like, shit, we could actually win this bloody game?
I think when Pouchy sort of went in, and then we had, like, a few wickets. I think Kempe got out. And then AB got out, so we almost thought maybe we're going to end up short, but not quite get there. And then Bouchy with a little bit of lower order cameos with Johan van der Vaart, Roger Telemarkus playing a role.
Yeah.
And then Mackay Antini's famous one, and then we managed to get over the line and Bouchy got 50 not out, and the rest was history. It was an unreal day. I think it's one of the days that, you know, you can't make sense of anything on the day. Even when I look back, and I mean, I think it was a 20-year reunion this year, and I mean, you look back and some of those things that happened on the day, you're like, unbelievable. You'll never experience again in your life.
That's probably the one night Herschel didn't drink. He was probably so gone.
No, I don't think so. I think I can confirm he might have had a few more. No, he's even his post-match speech was quite hilarious, encouraging everybody to have a good time and celebrate. But that was Herschel Gibbs, though, in a nutshell.
Sure. Your playing career was an incredible career. Were you always going to get into coaching, or, like, did you have other plans after your career?
I didn't have I've been sort of lucky. Like after my career, when I finished, I was sitting at the dinner table at one of the CSA awards, and someone came to me and said, "Oh, would you like to do commentary?" And I was like, "Yeah, okay, well, I'll have a crack at that." And then all of a sudden, I was in that, and then I got a call from Lawrence Mthlantla, who was the SNN 19 coach at the time, and asked, "Hey, would you like to be part of our group management group?" And sort of fell into that. But while I was still a player, Gary Kirsten would always encourage me to go into coaching. I'm not sure why, what he saw in me or whatever, but he was someone that sort of encouraged me to look into coaching and give it a crack and see if it's something I liked. And then, I mean, he got me down to coach at his academy a few times and sort of just trying to stimulate my thinking. But no, not really. I think it's something I stumbled onto. And then Shafiq Abrams, their coach left and they needed an interim coach. And we used to commentate together. Yeah. And then all of a sudden I was like, yeah, I'll help you out. I'm an EP boy.
Yeah.
You know, while you're looking for another coach, that was in 2019. And I'm still here. It's 2026 and I'm still here today. So I enjoyed it. I didn't think it was going to quite be as hard as I thought it was. You know, I've learned to respect coaches a lot more, the challenges they go through. And it is something that I've thoroughly enjoyed. You know, I've learned that it's not about you as a coach. You know, it's actually only about the players and the players performing. And it's a tough job because when you lose, you're under pressure and it's your fault. And when you win, you know, the players have been magnificent. So it's something that you have to, you know, be selfless about when you become a coach. But I've loved my journey so far. I don't know where it's going to end up, what it's going to be, but I hope it's going to have a few more great stories that I can look back on fondly.
I was going to ask you, I mean, you've had an unbelievable season, and one season doesn't make a coach, etc. But I think our domestic game is in good hands if the likes of yourselves and Russell Domingo and obviously AD Birrell now going to Lions with their 24-man management management team with 4,000 caps between them, etc. But it's great that Proteas legends are involved in the next generation, because that is the best way to learn. And it's, but do you have national ambitions?
I think firstly, to acknowledge all those coaches, I think it's great for them to be in our system. I think it's maybe for a while we've lost that. And it sort of seems to be coming back again. Agreed, even Justin Ontong coaching at Borland, done a great job with that team.
Yeah.
Rory Kleinfeld also had a decent season, you know, bringing through some young players down at Western Province. Obviously, you'd like to get them, you know, to silverware, which is where Western Province always want to be. But you know, it's fantastic, you know, to see all these guys. But in terms of national ambitions, of course, I think, you know, I don't think you can have goals as a coach, but I think you can have ambitions. And I think to coach, you know, internationally, and obviously with South Africa, then great. If it's not, then, you know, it's not meant to be. But I mean, just enjoying what I do. Yeah, I work with some of the best young players. And, you know, a lot of them go on to play for the Proteas. And, you know, if I can sort of have my little role to play in helping, you know, the Proteas, even if I'm not in that setup, I also see that as a goal, and I'm playing my role.
You obviously won the Warriors won, which I heard that, I was like, surely not. The Warriors won their first trophy for 15 years.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe that. Yeah. Surely not. I mean, the quality of players, and that's maybe the problem, is that the developed players then go straight to the Proteas, and you just keep on churning out, but you never did get to develop a team around a core group of players. This year you did that. How was that as a local boy? Have they given you the keys to the city, basically?
No, I think P is permanently open, so I don't think you need keys here. But it's been great. I mean, to win a title and sort of give them something to smile about it. I mean, Sunrise is here. I mean, it pains me to say it, but they've won three titles. And, you know, for us to get in positions to win it and win, you know, the domestic T20 title as a Warriors group. And a lot of my players play for Sunrisers.
Yeah.
So they've started accumulating that experience since SA20. And it's great to see them bring, you can see them bring it into the changing room, you know, when the pressure's on and the big games, and they're just getting better and better at it. So, no, I didn't get the keys to the city, but it's great when you walk around and people acknowledge that you've come back here and given back a little bit and bringing players through. And it's been great. You know, the players have been fantastic. I think what they really enjoy, because it's such a small city and, you know, they walk in the malls and the people know who they are and, you know, the local public is very close to the players. I think they play with a little bit more heart and passion over there. So it's something I think that's driven the players, especially when the pressure's been on.
Some, maybe like one or two young players that you've seen that's coming through. We've obviously got Matthew de Villiers and you can tell us about him, but shit, I've been impressed with him, eh? Like he's a quality player. You've thrown him into your T20 side and made him the captain in his first T20 game. He hadn't played a professional game.
Yeah.
There must be something special for you to do that.
Yeah, it's a funny story. He was talking about strategy on the day in his first game. And, you know, all of a sudden I'm giving him, someone's giving him his debut cap as well. So, I mean, he's someone that we've kept our eye on for a long time. I've heard about him in Cape Town. Richard Pybus has actually mentioned him to me, and he was the former
EWC coach,
Cobras coach, and he's currently working with Sri Lanka now. And you know, he sort of alerted me to him, and I kept up following cricket, and then spoke to Roger Telemarcus a little bit about him at Colts. What's he like? Because we were looking for a little bit of depth in our batting while we were developing a couple of our young players of our own. So. But I didn't expect anything of him. I told him, just be yourself this season. That was last season. And he had a tremendous breakout. Yeah, I mean, he got so many 90s and he got a double 100 in first-class cricket. And then, you know, this year he sort of showed me that he's got a fantastic understanding of cricket. For someone that hasn't, it's only in his second season. And, you know, when all our national players were away who were responsible for the captaincy, it fell on his shoulders. And I have to say, he's done magnificently well. He's got roots here. His uncle actually captained the Warriors in the first season of franchise cricket. Yeah. So
who's uncle?
Peter Stridham.
Striker
Stridham, who played for South Africa. So he's got a little bit of Eastern Cape roots. His mom's from here. His grandmother's still here in the city. So So he does have that.
So you didn't just poach him from Western Province and took him from there.
Well, you can only poach someone if they were playing for Western Province.
That is true. That's a fair point.
We didn't poach him, but we gave him an opportunity. And, you know, there are a lot of stories about guys that miss out in our system. You know, we got so much talent.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're not identified early, you can get lost in the system a little bit. Yeah. So, you know, we still try and find those rough diamonds over here and within our own system. But if there are one or two we can bring from outside, we try and do that too. And Matthew's done well, and he's fitted in beautifully. Yeah. You know, he's a humble boy. He's always willing to learn. And that's been a hallmark of probably the type of people we want here.
And that's obviously, I mean, he's been picked up by JSK. You know, there's opportunities there. You're part of MI Cape Town as well. We're going to talk about briefly about the SA20 and the franchise leagues. You're in that MI family. You obviously played for them in the IPL back in 2012, if I'm not mistaken. The money then wasn't as it was good back then and compared, but I mean, being in that Mumbai Indians family, there's something, unless you've been in it, just tell us what actually that means.
I think for me, personally, when the SA20 started, sort of director of cricket, Rahul Sanghvi, sort of contacted me months before, but he never ever mentioned the SA20. And he was like, hey, Robbie, we want you to do some work for us and scouting and doing all these things. And I was like, yeah, but I'm a coach. Like, you know, I can alert you to young players, but I'm not sure what you're asking. And then he says, okay, we'll continue this conversation over the course of a couple of months. And then next thing, it was SA20 was on the table. And then I was actually Sunrise's coach at one point.
Really?
So, and A.D. Burrell was my assistant. I brought A.D. Burrell on.
Wow. I did not know that.
Yeah, though. So that's an interesting story. And then A.D. and Burrell and I were, because I didn't have a formal deal with MI, even though I knew that I loved being part of that franchise and still support them today, you know, in the IPL. So I became the head coach here without actually signing a deal. And I was sort of, actually Aidan Markram was my first signing as head coach. So, you know, they wanted a captain and I said, no, get Aidan Markram.
Yeah.
And then when MI came to me and said, listen, you have to come back to us and, you know, I didn't have a formal deal on the table and I ended up going with sort of the franchise that I knew and I supported and had a little bit of a relationship with. with the guys in the background that run the franchise.
So, but you were DOC for MI in that first year, and Simon Kettage were the...
They gave me the role of general manager.
General manager.
So they were basically trying to educate me in the role and sort of be the eyes and help them with talent ID because I was a coach at the time. So, yeah, Simon Kettage was the coach. And then the following season, I took over the major league team.
Yeah.
In that season, we had a successful year. We ended up winning the inaugural major league. And, you know, that sort of kick-started my SA20 coaching career a little bit. So they took a chance on me in major league, probably because I was loyal to them in SA20 and my relationship with them. And then, you know, one thing led to another. And we ended up lost the first season. And then, you know, we sort of got everything right we needed in the third and ended up winning it. You know, in great style. So, you know, it was a great journey. But yeah, it was. Yeah. And I would have loved to have coached with AD because, you know, I thought that I needed someone alongside me who can learn from. Yeah. But to watch him do what he's done, has also been nothing short of phenomenal. And it's something we all look up to, actually.
It must be weird. So weird because you want cricket energized in this region.
Yeah.
You know, the Orange Army doing great and stuff. But you're the coach of the Cape Town side. But you want those fans to come and watch the Warriors. Yeah. A couple of months later, you know, it must be just so odd for you, but you know that your players are being developed and SA20, I suppose, is developing players around the country.
Yeah, believe me, when I walk around, the Orange Army and their fans don't ever make me forget who won the title 3 times. So, you know, still today it's amazing, that competition, SA20. It's fantastic. I mean, it reminds me a little bit of the old B&H days when I used to come sit in the stands. Mm. And watch day-night cricket and to watch all the kids and the families come in. And I mean, St. George's Park and Newlands are probably two of the best stadiums in SA20. Phenomenal. And the way the crowd and the public, you know, get behind their team is nothing short of amazing. And the players appreciate it because a lot of them sit in my dressing room. And believe me, not only the public give me a hard time. I think when I come back from SA20 and they've won, you know, they do give me a hard time in their dressing room.
I always like to chirp one or two of the players to say that, like, you know, SA20, your bus, your branded bus, brings you to the game, takes you home. Then a week later, you're playing a four-day game in Potch and you drive yourself in your in your own bus. You driving, Matthew Brietzka's driving, Tristan Stubbs is in the passenger seat and the rest of the boys are in the back. No police escort. But that shows you, you know, it does keep you grounded as well, I suppose.
No, it's something we speak about a lot. Like, you know, we speak about the SA20, staying in the hotels and just the whole hype around and fans coming in. And, and you know, and that's part of like being a coach is to remind them that, hey, this is where it all starts. And, you know, you're not the finished product yet. You still got to polish up, you know, your game and get better. And this is where you do it. So, you know, players can get ahead of themselves a little bit and take the foot off the SA20. But, you know, that's your responsibility as a coach is to make sure that they understand that, you know, I'm still going to do this part. I'm doing it. I worked in at MI, but if I'm prepared to do it, then, you know, we all got to do it at the end of the day.
You've upskilled yourself as well as from an education point of view, which I know about. And, like, how important is that not just to be like a upskilling yourself from a levels point of view, coaching levels, from a holistic point of view?
Yeah, I think it's really important if you're that way inclined. I think any growth experience is good for you as a cricket coach. You know, whether you go and work for a different organization for a couple of months and come back into coaching, you see maybe operationally how a real professional, you know, system does it. But yeah, I went to study in the UK, University of Manchester, did a master's in, you know, sports directorship, you know, which basically revolved around running high performance organizations and leadership and with the skills required to do that. So, it was a great learning experience. I think the first time you embark on that journey and you sort of crap yourself a little bit because you're like, it's been more than a decade since you've actually had to submit assignments and do all these things. So, you know, I had a lot of support in the background in terms of, you know, helping me get over to the UK because I had to fly up to block lectures, you know, when I had opportunity and actually go sit in a class. But what an experience, you know.
Amazing.
Luke Wright was the convener of selectors, was in my class. Dane Villas, my ex-teammate, was in my class. And then guys from different, you know, sporting organizations, from Manchester United, Liverpool, Arsenal, you know. So it was a great course because I think that network, you know, you're still in touch with the guys today.
Amazing. You never know where you're going to land up.
No, 100%.
Any ambitions to go and coach in county cricket or anything like that? Or is it you concentrating on developing the youngsters here?
I think, like I said initially, I don't think you can have goals. You can have ambitions. I think coaching county cricket may be at the back end, or we'll see where it goes. I think I really enjoy developing a team. I think that's one thing I have realized in coaching. I think franchise cricket gives you joy when you win.
Yeah.
But I think when you develop a group of players over a long period of time. And I mean, I've watched Matthew Bredsky go from 18 years old to being 27 and, you know, performing like he is, and Tristan Stubbs and Marco Janssens. So you do a journey with cricketers. And I think that's what resonates with me a little bit. So if there's anything that I enjoy, I'd probably say I enjoy the sort of glitz and the pressure of quick tournaments in franchise cricket, but there's no doubt that connecting and growing a group of players definitely resonates with me.
Did becoming a dad a few years ago help with your coaching? It came at a time where you were, your boy's how old now?
He's 9 years old. Yeah. Hopper. Yeah, no, it definitely did. I mean, he's here at the moment. I mean, it's great because I never had the opportunity. He had to travel with teams and be in changing rooms. And that's the access he has now. We come here. I remember my first game at St. George's. You sort of like nervous, and you've always looked at this at being this big thing. But, you know, you watch him. He runs around St. George's. He's in the dressing room. He knows Bredsky, Stubbs, Jordan Hermans, all these players. And this is normal for him. So, you know, it kind of normalizes a little bit for him, even though I don't know if he's going to become a cricketer. But if he does, I didn't want this to be sort of a stage that he should be fearful of. And, you know, it's great. Did it help my coaching? Of course. You know, you learn patience, you learn how to communicate. But I reckon my coaching helped me become a sort of more patient dad.
Gotcha.
You know, so I think it's worked both ways a little bit.
I wanted to ask you, are you going to the IPL at all? Do you get to go over as part of the MI family?
I have gone for the last couple of years, but it's just for a couple of days to a week. I think when MI tend to play a block of games at home, and that coincides with meeting the owner and just sort of watching the games and meeting some of the players at the hotel. So,
yeah,
I do. It's something I look forward to. And, you know, hopefully the last time we were there, they were under a little bit of pressure. And I think they're hunting that sixth title badly. So hopefully... if I go up, it'll be for happier times.
We've got a declaration, it's called. It's a few quick fire questions at the end. Just to conclude. Okay, so your favorite batsman to bowl to, besides with Brian Lara?
I'm going to actually say Brian Lara. Even though he hit me for 28. By the way, Stuart Broad broke that record not too long ago.
Yeah, thanks to Stuart. Yeah,
thanks, Stuart. Jassie Broomer, I hit him in my voice. So.
Do you want to get anything off your chest about that over? Like, I wanted to ask you, but I didn't want to ask you because I don't know how you would react. But
no, listen. I am so... I don't believe like you learn a lot from success. So when you go through those types of situations, I mean, I loved it when I look back. At the time, it knocks your ego. You question whether you're good enough. But I was only 20 years old, 21 years old at the time.
Forget about that,
You know, I was like only a baby. I didn't know whether I was good enough at the time. And it probably picked me too early, if I'm brutally honest. But what I do remember about that was actually preparing to bowl at Brian. And I actually got him stumped. Well, I beat him and he ran down the crease, obviously trying to dictate terms in the 50-over game. Unfortunately, Boucher missed the stumping. But it was a great learning moment. But I enjoyed it, you know.
Yeah, and thanks to Stuart Broad for taking it over. Happy to hand that mantle, that record over.
Well, thanks to Jasprit Bumrah, MI connection.
Of all the people. The most underrated teammate you've ever played with?
Justin Onton. I think he was probably the most underrated player. I don't think he got the opportunities for South Africa, as he probably should. Someone that can feel the way he does, play spin. He was probably one of the main reasons the Cobras won so many titles, but he doesn't actually get the accolades he deserves for it. And you could bowl off spin, leg spin. You could bowl like Muralitharan. Mm. I mean, he would be an unbelievable T20 signing today, you know. So I think if I had to look back, he's probably someone that was probably the most underrated.
I like that one. Mm. There's, if you could change one rule in cricket, one law that's current in cricket, what would it be?
I kind of like what they're trying with the concussion replacements. I think I was always someone that wanted that a few years ago. And, you know, even not only concussion, just injury replacements in games. I think they're trialing it in our domestic cricket this season. And I think it's worked quite well.
Yeah.
So I'd like to see them carry that on in international cricket, not only for concussions, but for serious injury.
I like that. Yeah. Worst roommate of all time?
I don't want to say, no, he was a good roommate, but someone, I'll answer this a bit differently, was Ashiel Prince was a great roommate. I enjoyed like rooming with him, but he used to sleepwalk. So it used to freak me out initially, but then when you did it for a long period of time, you got used to it. So you'd hear someone get up and like, but then afterwards you go to sleep. But no, Ashiel, great roommate, but he used to sleepwalk. So.
Oh, that's so funny. Yeah.
Bless
the craziest thing you've ever seen on a cricket field.
I have to sort of knock myself here a little bit. I got run out at this ground, and I think Ashim Amla and Russell Domingo still take the mickey out of me for it. Unfortunately, I'll try and send you the video if I can find it. But I defended a ball, and it was in a four-day game, and the bowler wanted to run me out, but it was aggressive. And I saw the ball trickle and I saw him look away to turn around. Mm. And I thought, I'm going to take the single now. And he ended up running me out by like a third. He caught me just as he ran me out. And I remember falling over myself and dusting myself off. And the opposition was celebrating the knights, and I had to go between them, pick my bat up, and all this was caught on my camera. So it's never left me, but that's one of the weirdest things I think that people still remind me of.
Yeah. That's a great one.
And I'll send
actually.
You the video.
Please do. We'll incorporate it. And then final question. One thing you really miss from playing cricket versus where you are now in your coaching?
I think playing cricket, I enjoyed being in the contest, you know, playing and being active and just touring the world. And, you know, people ask me, what are the highlights of your career? I have to say, you only remember the celebrations, winning at Lord's, beating England in England, beating Australia in Australia for the first time. You know, these are things that you don't ever remember the statistics of the game, but what the dressing room was like afterwards, it was electric. You know, everybody, the camaraderie, even the tough times before, you know, you never remember the stats of anything. It's always, you know, the sort of team spirit and the mateship, whatever the Aussies call it, and the kias, whatever we call it in South Africa. Those are the things I really miss about cricket. And then from a coaching perspective is, you know, you're always trying to put cricket teams in position to experience that because you don't experience that from winning and success. Yes. And that's what that's the other side of it that I love doing.
I'm going to finish off with a very serious question now. I hope you're ready. What is in your mug in the dugout every single match that we see you on TV? Are you always drinking or eating something?
Well, I wouldn't say eating. Maybe I've packed on a bit since mid-season after SA20. But
tea, coffee, or a little bit stronger?
It's just coffee. I think Ashim Amla and myself, we kind of have this agreement that every other person will get the coffee.
Yeah.
So it's coffee and my cricket ball. That's what I'm...
yes, you're always playing with the cricket ball.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it's like my blanket that kids have. But I don't know. I've always had the cricket ball in my hand since a player.
Mm.
But it's definitely nothing stronger than coffee.
That's cleared up now. Robbie P, thanks for having us at your home. We've been to Dave Callahan's home in a previous episode, but this is your home. This is your ground. This is a beautiful ground. Unbelievable ground. Well done on an incredible season. And hopefully there's more success and more talent coming through this region. It's only going to bode well for South African cricket. Thank you very much for being on The Biggest Man in Cricket, mate.
No, thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.